favorite show. More Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. That means it's time for the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. I'm joined in studio by Simon Allison, our chief Africa coverer, reporter, correspondent, Maverick. Welcome back, Simon. It's been a while since we've had you in studio.
Yeah, it has. It's been an eventful couple of weeks, but I'm alive.
Made it back from Thailand.
Thailand, a little bout of dengue fever, which was exciting.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, as long as it's not, a little bit of overshare there, but thanks, Simon.
You're welcome.
To have you back anyway. I think just make sure you sit in the corner there and don't breathe this way, don't cough this way. Duncan and I might just call the Ebola police on you. So we'll be covering a couple of issues from the First Thing newsletter, which you can also get at cliffcentral.com under the Daily Dose banner. We'll have Greg Nicholson joining us in the studio a little bit later to tell us about some of the efforts and the plights of the TAC that he's been covering. And we'll have Rebecca Davis on the line to us from Cape Town, attending a press conference about mortality rates and the causes of death in South Africa. And probably some interesting stats to come out of that, I suspect. But we'll kick off with an interesting snippet from this morning's First Thing newsletter, which showed that experts at in Oxford in England have noticed that after some studies that they've done, that the HIV virus is becoming less destructive, which is quite interesting and surprising. Usually you expect viruses to mutate and evolve and become more destructive, like we've seen with the TB virus becoming drug resistant and becoming a very big problem in South Africa. It's quite strange that it seems to be going the other way.
So it is. It's almost counter-evolutionary at first. But then I guess the argument is that actually by becoming less dangerous, it's less of a target. In a strange sort of
reverse psychology, right?
Some of the most effective evolutionary animals are the domesticated ones. You know, cats and dogs. They've done really well by basically dropping their defenses against humans, at least.
Right.
And I wonder if there's something similar here, that the HIV, if it continued to be as virulent as it was definitely going to be taken out at some stage or another. So maybe in a weird kind of way, it's the less effective strains are the ones that are surviving because they're not quite as dangerous.
Well, you could almost apply that to what's been happening with the TAC, obviously, as a body. Now, and this is a little bit of mental gymnastics, but you know, in our minds, you know, ARVs were being dished out. You know, people are living longer and living almost normal lives. You know, with ARVs and with the virus, that sort of red alert had, you know, been clocked back down to amber. And you know, all of a sudden we didn't need the TAC anymore, which is obviously crap. But it's kind of like there was the mentality. Mm. So strange that, yeah, you mentioned it as an evolutionary tactic. A couple of facts, given that it's World AIDS Day yesterday. And keeping with the theme, do you know how many people are infected with HIV/AIDS in South Africa, an estimate?
I do not.
Their number is the single most for any country in the world. As a percentage of the population, is 6.4 million people are estimated to be living with
sort of people. So what? That's more than 10%.
Yeah, it's nearing on 15%. Yeah, between 12 and 15%.
Incredible, because it really has HIV and AIDS has declined in significance in terms of the national sort of dialogue. Mm-hmm. We don't have huge debates about HIV and AIDS anymore, do we?
Well, I mean, that was obviously spurred on by AIDS denialism under Thabo Mbeki, mm-hmm. for example, and garlic and you know, being mooted as a treatment for it. And obviously, you know, hundreds of thousands of people lost their lives because of the government's refusal to engage in the ARV program. It just seems to be now that scary part was over, ARVs became part of the government policy, that it's kind of sort of, you know, taken a lesser a lesser point of view from the scandals and the murder issues that South Africa faces.
And that is, it's got to be a credit, and he needs a few credits to poor old Jacob Zuma. Mm-hmm. That is something that he turned around, and he made quite drastic changes in as soon as he came into power. And surely that's a good thing. We mustn't forget that when we criticize him for everything else he does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's great, and we should give him that credit, but at the end of the day, he was just doing something that was logical and was his job, right? So let's not go too far.
And then you do ask yourself, what would his stance have been if Thabo Mbeki was the logical one? Would he have been the beetroot supporter, you know? How much of it was just purely doing the opposite of what Thabo Mbeki did?
Well, and if your benchmark is an idiot who cost 500,000 people their lives and should basically be hung by his testicles in, you know, town square, if that's the benchmark that we're using, you know, let's not go too far. some of the other facts around HIV and AIDS with regards to South African infections is that less than a third of those 6.4 million people who are estimated to be living with HIV are actually getting treatment. Less than a third, which means that there's a significant number, like something like 4 million people who are out there who aren't getting treatment. And this obviously comes back to the relevance of an organization like the TAC and the role that they still need to play in South Africa when you consider that something like 10% of the population, just under 10% of the population, is living with HIV and isn't getting any treatment. And then, you know, that number then transpires into a massive proportion. Something like 42% of all deaths in South Africa in 2010 were due to HIV/AIDS. So 280,000 people were estimated to have died from HIV/AIDS related causes in 2010.
So this is interesting. I was just listening to Stephen Hurtis in the Midday Report as I was driving into the studio, and he had Pali Lehotla, the South African statistician general, on the line talking about the death figures for South Africa. And interestingly, officially, I think there's only something like 27,000 people died from HIV/AIDS in the last year.
According to the official stats.
Mm. And of course, there's this big discrepancy between what doctors actually put on their death certificate and what the real cause of disease is. And I mean, how do you tell these things? Because someone ultimately doesn't die of HIV; they die of, say, tuberculosis.
And that's not what gets recorded as the official cause of death, causing the discrepancy between the estimates and the actual numbers. We've just been joined by Greg Nicholson. Thank you for making it into the studio, Greg. We've just run through a whole bunch of AIDS, HIV/AIDS stats and facts. We straight into the death and destruction. Not even the quirky random fact anymore. Just straight in with the death. But given it was World AIDS Day yesterday, we thought we'd look up some of these stats just to bring home the impact. You know, it's almost been out of sight, out of mind for a while, and which obviously leads into a lot of the troubles that the TAC is finding, in that people think that now that the ARV program is being rolled out by government, it's no longer an issue. They no longer have a role to play. But looking at these stats, 6.4 million people estimated to be living with HIV in South Africa. Less than a third are getting treatment. And still something like 280,000 people per year are dying from HIV/AIDS-related issues. You've been following the TAC's plight. How's it going with their fundraising efforts? Are they going to see it through into the next year?
So far, it hasn't gone so successfully. They aimed to raise 10 million rand during the month of November, but they only raised, I think it was almost 2 million, and that was with a really, really big international campaign pushing for all these things to raise a lot of money and drawing in people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Crush on Michelle. The Daily Maverick. We definitely did support them quite a bit. And it's actually quite scary because even with this huge campaign, if they can't even raise, they didn't even manage to raise a fifth of their targeted funds, It's looking quite worrying. At the moment, they said their latest announcement yesterday was that they are close to sealing a $1 million deal, which would be about 10 million rand, which would really, really help them.
So this is basically just enough to get them through into next year, which will give them more time to fundraise for the balance of the 35 million rand budget that they need on an annual basis.
That's right, but it could be quite scary, because what they'll end up doing is, if they don't get that that full operational budget, they'll actually cut down their programs. So it looks like now they've got enough money, for example, to run one key program, which would be the sort of Eastern Cape health issue, just to try and improve just general services in the Eastern Cape, largely at clinic and hospital level.
Is that because the Eastern Cape is hardest hit by sort of poor management in the province?
One of them, definitely. With Eastern Cape, Free State, Gauteng, all have huge problems, but they've been working quite hard in the Eastern Cape, and with the previous MEC that was there, there was almost no engagement and no improvement. Only hospitals and clinics really, really have deteriorated.
And that key program, would that still focus on HIV/AIDS, or would it include the TB efforts that they've now sort of branched into?
Well, that's one of the things now. With the current push to try and completely stop or significantly reduce HIV infections and increase treatment, get more people on treatment and get more people taking their treatment consistently, you can't just look at HIV/AIDS issues. You have to look at it ties into all other sort of things. So obviously it ties into TB, but then even such things just as basic services at clinics, trying to improve staff care, cut down waiting times, make sure there are no drug stockouts. These things are really, really crucial in terms of addressing HIV/AIDS, because, for example, if already we face stigma and things like that, so you don't want to get tested or you're worried about getting treated and things like that. So, but then if you have to take a day off work and go to the clinic and then wait there for 8 or 9 hours and then you still don't get your medication because there's a stock out, it really puts people off either going to seek treatment or testing and continuing with their ARVs. And then we have a really, really big problem right now in South Africa in that I think it's something like around about, I can't remember the exact figures, but it's under both around about 40 and 30% in terms of people getting on ARVs, and then within 3 years they're not consistent taking their medication anymore, and that sort of really does inhibit our fight against HIV/AIDS.
Which is from a combination of those factors:
stockouts,
the time to the effort required, because it's just so hard that the program hasn't made it easy for people to maintain and to stay on the program.
That's right. So we have this huge ARV program where about 2.5 million, around 2.5 million people are on treatment. But keeping them on treatment, and obviously with those figures you suggested, we have to increase the number of people on treatment still, it requires a functional health system. And that is a much bigger challenge than just rolling out ARVs. Now what we have to do is get our actual clinics and hospitals running effectively, and that's a much, much harder challenge.
It comes back to that the TAC does have a massive role still to play. We're so far away from what the optimal situation is, and it's sad that in a country that has probably the biggest problem as a percentage of the population, that our government hasn't put more resources, more effort behind rolling out an effective program, and B, that we can't support the one organization that has made sure that the poor efforts we've seen to date, the poor results we've seen to date, or the only ones we've seen to date, they're pretty much responsible that we've gotten to that, at least that stage.
They are. I think on the government issue, we have to give the government credit, particularly under Zuma and Aaron Motsoaledi, the health minister, for rolling out this ARV program, and look at how far we've come from the dark days of Mbeki denialism. Because they have put significant resources in, and the government spends a whole lot of money trying to prevent and treat HIV/AIDS. But now the problem is, it's often more similar to a lot of other government problems we have. So something like the rollout of housing. It relates to the councillors we have, it relates to the MECs, and it relates to the premiers largely. And so now trying to get those systems to work is much more difficult. And what the government's done is, so they've got this, they've got a positive and a well-regarded program to address HIV/AIDS and TB, but, and it could still have improvements, but in terms of actually making it work and not just dumping all this money in this huge program, that's the real challenge. And we have, I think, dropped the ball in the last few years. Everyone praised Motsoaledi when and Zuma as well, for what they've done for HIV/AIDS, and then sort of said, oh, fantastic, thumbs up. But then no one really looked at, okay, how are we actually going to make this system work in the next few years? How
implementation.
That's right. How is someone in a rural
village?
Usually
the problem with most programs.
That's right. And we have corrupt or either corrupt officials still in, like we do in a lot of government structures, as well as just people who can't manage what they're doing. And it's extremely worrying that we're just neglecting the TAC now, because you're right in that they have effectively caused the key improvements in this system. It wasn't the government who led it. It was them who put the pressure or led the sort of coalition of different bodies to put the pressure on the government to improve their services. And now for us to just, or for everybody to really just sort of put their hands up and say we don't need to support these activists anymore is extremely scary. It's extremely scary because the TAC, the key function that it serves is mobilizing people on the ground and giving patients voices.
How many branches do they operate currently under the existing budget?
I think it's around 190, with about 8,000 volunteers and I think towards 20,000 members.
That's the size of a government department, the efforts of a government department.
We're talking about the biggest activist organization, I think, in the country.
You know, 35 million rand annual budget sounds like a lot of money, right? But when you think that they're doing, you know, a major piece of work that, you know, a government budget would probably, you know, cost the taxpayer R1 billion, you know, plus in order to get the same, you know, the same results. It's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, it's an Kandla chicken run or something. So, it's not much, but I think it's been quite disappointing in terms of the international, both international and local response. Internationally, we've seen donors deciding to shift their response to HIV/AIDS out of South Africa because they think now South Africa's international donors have largely helped South Africa improve its systems.
We've moved out of that sort of developing nation
status. The crisis phase, into much more of a trying to get the little things right phase. But it feels and looks like we've been neglected, you know. Mm. And obviously we can't always blame international
donors. Well, it's just, the pot just isn't, it's not a never-ending pot of money,
right?
It's aid money, right?
That's right. And then we have to look at internally in South Africa. We do have people who can donate that much money, either through, you know, middle and lower income people in terms of just crowdfunding type donations.
Or people like Patrice Motsepe who donated $1 million to Ebola research.
That's right.
Greg, how much money does the EFF have? Could they ostensibly...
There's a lot of berets out there.
I mean, I'm wondering if for a political party, this could be a genius thing to put a bit of money behind.
The TAC have been adamant that they're not going to take any money that that comes with strings attached. So they've said they're not going to take any government money unless it's clearly stated that there are no conditions. Mm-hmm. And even then, I don't think they'll take government money because there might be suggested sort of biases, and I think their image might look like it's their image and stances might be diluted. So they're really pushing private and foreign donors, but we're not sure how that's going to go. And as far as I can tell, there haven't been any large donations from either private South Africa or wealthy individuals.
We've got Rebecca lined up to join us in a couple of moments. But Simon, I wanted to ask you this. So an issue like this is a breeding ground for fake drugs to basically enter, you know, people to start peddling something like fake easy access.
Nutritional supplements.
So fake ARVs. And this is, we often see this stories coming out of the continent where there are, you know, cartels pushing, you know, fake drugs onto poor, unsuspecting Africans. I don't know if this was a story that maybe you had covered in the past or not, but it's something that stuck out. And you can just see this as a fertile ground for, you know, desperate people to be taken advantage of.
Well, you know, it depends a lot on the specific context of the drug itself. And with ARVs, I think now we get our ARVs from India, and they're basically generics. Mm. And the thing is, you're going to struggle to make fake drugs cheaper than the real drugs are made.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's so much a problem when it comes to the likes of ARVs. And if you do want to get ARVs, I think that you're just not going to find fake ones cheaper than the real ones if you can get hold of them.
Yeah, if you can get hold of them under the normal channels or the proper channels, I think that was the point. Okay, we've got still a couple more minutes to go. Simon, some elections happening in one of our nearest neighbours.
More bloody elections. This has been a lot of elections this year in the SADC region. There was Malawi, Mozambique, Botswana, South Africa, of course, and now we've got Namibia. And out of those five elections, four of them returned the ruling party. Four of them, those countries have only ever known the ruling party in power. It's quite a strange twist on democracy that Southern Africa has got going on at the moment. This idea that if you freed the country from power, then you sort of get to sit in power for quite a long time. Now, what's happened in Namibia is...
And enjoy the fruits,
exactly. What's happened in Namibia is that the ruling party, SWAPO, they have... their results are better than ever, actually. This is the best ever showing they've had in an election. And they were already sitting on a two-thirds majority in parliament. The presidential candidate, a new guy called Hage Geingob, he was the prime minister, and now he will be president. He won nearly 87% of the vote.
Wow.
I mean, that's dominance right there.
How does that compare against the actual performance of the country, you know,
This is the interesting thing. So the people I tend to talk to are the people like the think tankers, the academics, the researchers, the journalists, the politicians.
The cynics.
and, you know, that class of people, no matter what country they're in, they're all saying, you know, within Southern Africa, Botswana, Mozambique, South Africa, Namibia, they're all saying the same thing. They're saying, you know, from where they're sitting, in their positions of, you know, these are elites, these are well-educated elites, and they look around and they're like, well, I can't understand why are the people constantly voting these parties back into power. They're not delivering. They are not... taking advantage of the resources of the country to actually provide decent services like healthcare and education and welfare. It's all being lost in corruption and mismanagement, and yet they keep coming back. So I think it's actually, as a region, it's something we have to think long and hard about, because it's very patronizing to sit here in the ivory tower and say, well, the people got it wrong. And a lot of the, you know, there was a lot of reaction after the South African election that said, well, you know, what are these stupid people doing voting back the ANC? Well, it's not as simple as that. People are not stupid. People generally vote in their own best interests. So what they think, clearly what people are thinking, is that keeping these ruling parties in power is in their own best interest. And you know what? They're not necessarily wrong. You look around at places that have a lot of political change. Most recently, say, Burkina Faso. Political change doesn't necessarily create these amazing social welfare democratic conditions that we think it's going to.
So it's a case of the devil you know rather than the devil you don't.
I think so. I think that ultimately
is probably combined also with a case of, you know, priorities for, you know, the masses are very different to the priorities of the well-off to-do elite sitting behind, you know, and often cynical. Combined also probably with a little bit of the glow of liberation lasts for a long time.
It does.
You know, that, you know, you don't just erode that overnight. That takes a long time. I mean, you know, you mentioned in your article today that you know, that there are almost daily cases of corruption and scandals that seem to be dominating the media there, which obviously, I mean, you know, brings parallels to what's going on in South Africa, to what's happening in Namibia, although there seems to be a slight reversal of the support for the ruling party in this country.
Just a little bit. We're still talking, how much did the ANC get? 60%?
62.
Yeah. 62. I mean, these are huge numbers. Yeah. I don't know. It's something we really need to look at and and think about, and, you know, maybe it's the right thing. Southern Africa is an extraordinarily stable part of Africa, mm-hmm. has been for the last few decades. It is growing economically. Things are getting better mm-hmm. for the people in this region. Maybe we just need to, you know, as are the sort of educated, literati, intelligentsia, we just need to calm down and just accept that things don't happen
keep
that
quickly. Calm and drink wine. Yeah, and also, I mean, the base, the standard of living that the masses have come off, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. their lives have improved significantly. So mm-hmm. it's not like, you know, it's not like they have the complaints and grievances that those elites have. But what does this mean for Namibia? 80-odd% majority. What are your fears, you know, that they can do with that majority?
Well, this is interesting. So in, I think it was June or, well, it was late July or early August, the ruling party, SWAPO, rammed through 42 constitutional amendments. Now, some of these were just, you know, changing wording and just tightening up the constitution, but some were fundamentally altering the sort of makeup of the state. They introduced this position of a vice president, which did not exist before. They also introduced something like 18 new members of parliament, a bunch of whom would be appointed by the party instead of sort of elected wow. from the lists. So sort of almost like a discretionary fund of MP seats that they could dole out to supporters. Now, both of those were clearly designed, especially the vice presidency, was designed to bring more power into the executive branch. It was designed to give SWAPO a little bit more leeway so they could give the president to say one tribal representative and give the vice president to another tribal representative, or, you know, they gave them a way to deal with some of the divisions in Namibian politics. Clearly, this was planning for a long-term SWAPO rule. Now, at the time, this was very controversial. People were saying, you can't just ram through these constitutional amendments designed to help you keep power better within your own party. Yet the electorate said, that's okay. We don't mind. We're very happy with this. So
just keep on doing what you're doing.
The fear is that this is going to embolden the ruling party to take even more liberties, to really put their stamp on the country, to basically diminish those divisions between the state and the party itself.
Two things that I'd like to ask is, number one, in these countries, do we see strong, organized and viable opposition parties? And secondly, how trustworthy are these elections? Are they free, fair and credible? Since the Kampepe report on the Zimbabwean election, you know, 12 years ago, it seems hard to trust anything
now. It is hard to trust. I think the Namibian election's fine. No one's raising any complaints. As far as their opposition parties, no, that's a big problem. They do not have any kind of credible or legitimate opposition. The most serious opposition.
Now maybe there's an opportunity for the EFF expansion into.
There is.
There's an Namibian EFF.
There is.
And they heckled the SADC observer mission as they delivered their results.
Sounds quite like EFF.
It does, doesn't it? I think there are.
I'm starting to see a pattern.
There are only four Namibian EFF members, or something ridiculous.
Okay.
They're a complete non-entity, but they do make for some good headlines. As they always do. That's a problem, that there isn't really a strong opposition. It was an interesting case. This guy called McHenry Venani, and he he's an opposition leader from the Democratic Turnhalle Alliance. Now, he came second in the presidential vote. He didn't even manage to win 5%, and he still came second. But he, you know, he was interesting because he would go and like spend 5 nights in a shanty town in a shack and commute to work with the people, and then he'd go to a sort of tribal reserve area and spend a few days there, and he'd go to his rallies on donkey carts and stuff like that, and he caused quite a stir. There was a lot of he got a lot of attention, and but you know, ultimately. Even his relatively sophisticated campaign made absolutely no dent whatsoever in the final numbers.
We're going to have to leave it there for a moment, Simon. We've got Rebecca Davis on the line from Cape Town. Rebecca, you with us?
Hello. How are you?
We're good. I believe you've just come from a press conference about something quite morbid.
Yes, I have literally more morbidity. South African mortality rates, causes of death, what we're dying of. And the answer is not crime. Unbelievably enough, the answer is basically preventable disease. It really is quite something, though, when you look at these figures and you realize to what degree crime dominates our national narrative, when really we should be up in arms about the state of our health system. I mean, just the fact that so many infants still die of malnutrition. I mean, it's like, what is this? Ethiopia in the 80s, you know what I mean? The fact that, you know, diabetes, it's something like 50 people per day die of diabetes in South Africa. I mean, that doesn't have to happen, you know? So it's really something. The percentage of people who die in South Africa from either crime or road accidents is actually only 10%. I know that's probably far higher than the rest of the world, but sometimes it doesn't feel like that at all. 90% of the other deaths are due to largely preventable illnesses. I mean, that to me is actually quite a striking figure.
Rebecca, we had a question earlier where a study done in 2010 showed that, you know, 280,000 people had died of HIV/AIDS-related causes in 2010. But more recently, we've seen that the number actually officially attributed to that, coming out of statistics, is a much smaller number, only 27,000, or, you know, just 10% of the number that's actually estimated. What did those numbers come through in the conference today?
As of today, the stats say that HIV-related causes or HIV disease has actually risen in terms of cause of death. So it used to be the seventh leading cause of death around about 2011. In 2012, it was the sixth leading cause of death. And as of last year, which is the most recent stats, 2013, it's now third. But they said it's not necessarily cause for assuming that there's a great prevalence, just more the doctors are now feeling more comfortable about recording it as a cause of death. So it used to be the case that doctors were really nervous about recording HIV as a cause of death because they were worried that it would affect families' insurance, because families asked them not to do it out of stigma and so forth. And it seems that because of training and because of various changes to life insurance regulations, people are getting better at it. So it's not necessarily that the number of deaths due to HIV are increasing, but it is the case that it's now risen on the list of leading causes of death.
Did they put any absolute numbers to those percentages or those rankings?
So there's basically 458,933 deaths were recorded in South Africa in 2013, which is 8.6 deaths per 1,000 people. That's altogether. That is both natural and unnatural causes. And of those, the highest death rate per 1,000 people occurred in the Free State and the lowest in Gauteng and in the Western Cape. Most people die in hospital, 44%, 23% at home, and the rest you have to see in slightly less comfortable environments.
So does this mean you'll be aiming your journalistic laser at the Department of Health going forward?
It was one of the conclusions I walked away with, that perhaps we do tend to spend too much time on crime and too little on health. And I think there's probably some not terribly positive reasons for that, that, you know, the fear of crime, the fear of road accidents, for instance, that they cut across all threads of society rather than, for instance, infant mortality being largely restricted to something that poor people die from. So, I mean, I think there are, you know, social reasons why crime tends to get focused on more, and then they're not good reasons. We should be focusing more on health. I know that the headline, yet another person dies of AIDS today, is not as gripping, perhaps, as yet another person murdered in the street. But, you know, it's more indicative of what's actually happening out there.
It's quite interesting you mentioned that point of what dominates the media coverage is it's someone else's problem. It's someone else, it's the other people, it's the other 99% that doesn't affect me. Should we as the media be taking a hard look at ourselves in that respect? And what can we do to change that?
Look, it is really hard because people tend to skip over stories about health if they don't directly affect them. You know, we all tend to suffer, I think, from this kind of social justice fatigue. So much bad news, so many things that seem intractable problems. You're faced with this, like, chaotic health system. It's a big, baseless problem, even what's to do with it. I think journalists should be focusing more on telling very human stories, putting faces to the problems, in the hope of sort of galvanizing people. But I think the sad reality, too, is that a lot of people don't care about issues until they directly affect them. It's just simple as, until your mother dies of cancer, you know, you've never really given cancer.
Maybe we need Oscar to contract TB.
He's in prison now, so we can see the government's TV prison program at work. Rebecca, it's Greg here. I just want to ask, did the chief statistician have any harsh words for the government on or society on these preventable diseases being the largest causes of the deaths, or did he just sort of present the numbers up front and let you make your own interpretation?
So I get the feeling that the statistician general is not prone to sort of political grandstanding in the same way that we see from these other sort of hairy political figures like the auditor general and so forth. So there wasn't really any condemnation. In fact, the tone of the briefing I was discussing with a fellow journalist afterwards was sort of oddly upbeat. There were moments of levity, which struck me as a bit odd considering the sort of dark subject matter, and also some strange sort of philosophical statements. So the statistician general started off by defining death for us very handily, because of course it is something that we all grapple with. And he said, death is a permanent disappearance of all evidence of life after a live birth has occurred. It's actually a very interesting definition, because as someone tweeted to me for a start, it's seems to jurisprudentially rule out abortion as being, you know, murder, because that's not after
or
a
even death.
Or death, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know where the statistician general gets his metaphysical readings from, but it's interesting stuff nonetheless.
Rebecca, we spent a bit of time talking about the plight of the TAC at the beginning of this radio show. Do you walk away from that press conference thinking, yes, we still as a country need organizations like the TAC and other civil society movements to be going on and continuing the good work that they've done in the past?
I mean, most definitely, but you also have to think about the fact that, you know, HIV is realistically not the leading cause of death in South Africa, that TB, and admittedly TB and HIV obviously interact hugely, is up there, things like diabetes as well. So while I, of course, fully acknowledge the work done by the TAC, and particularly historically, we've also got to look at the fact that, you know, there are a lot of other health issues out there other than AIDS, and that there are a lot of other civil society organizations trying to do their best they can with budgets far smaller than what the TAC is asking for. So, I mean, obviously, no disputing from me that the value that we owe to the TSC, but I think let's also be aware that there are other NGOs out there also desperately in need of funds and also doing very valuable work.
Before we let you go, you wrote another piece about some justice being served for a change, it seems, in our courts, about the Supreme Court of Appeal that handed out a sentence to J. Arthur Brown, he of the Fidentia notoriety. What was your takeaway from that sentencing after that, what seemed like a ludicrous initial suspended sentence and fine?
Elated, thank you. I mean, people probably did, because it seemed, I mean, a lot of us obviously don't have a huge amount of detailed knowledge of the case, but it did seem like justice seemed to be done in a very sort of decisive way for once in South Africa. And also interesting to think of it in terms of cases like the Pistorius appeal, which will probably be heard in Bloemfontein, just to note just how drastically the Supreme Court of Appeal can change the outcome of a court case, you know what I mean? I mean, this is a man who originally walked away with 150,000 rand fine, no jail time whatsoever, who is now being told to report to the nearest prison, you know, to spend the next, hopefully, a great part of the next 15 years in jail. So it is a reminder that the Supreme Court of Appeal has a great deal of power and, you know, will not hesitate to smack down a judgment when they find it incorrect. And in this particular case, the original judge in the J. Arthur Brown case came in for particular criticism. They said he'd shown the judge, Falthazen, from the West Cape High Court, had shown far too much leeway to the accused. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of dynamic might play out in the Pistorius case.
this is something that keeps cropping up every time there's a major financial case of this nature, especially with fraud cases where curators never seem to be far from controversy in cases like this.
Indeed. To be totally honest, I don't know a huge amount about curatorship. But the problem is that in this case, the curators who were placed in charge of Cadentia, J. Arthur Brown's firm, appeared to have been not too far from controversy themselves. The Financial Services Board itself has also been mired in controversy, with their CEO stepping down under suggestions of malfeasance as well. So it's been a very murky general insight into South Africa's commercial world. And for a lot of people, it's been symptomatic of the fact that, first of all, that commercial crime in South Africa often goes unnoticed, it goes unreported, and it goes unpunished. And that the National Prosecuting Authority's corporate commercial crime division is particularly poor at bringing these cases to justice. So, I mean, if it's a sign that things are moving in the right direction, that would be extremely helpful, because these kind of scams happen all the time.
Yeah, I was just thinking back to the Barry Tannenbaum case, pyramid scheme, and that also ended up with a case of, you know, the creators being pointed the finger at. And it's just, I mean, when you look at the fees that these guys end up, you know, pulling out of these schemes at the end of the day, it seems like the only people who win are the curators at the end of the day. So I'm not surprised that,
you know, some lawyers making a few bucks as well.
Yeah, it's always, you know, when these things happen, it's always the lawyers that are the lawyers and the damn accountants and, you know, the people keep getting screwed over, it seems.
No, that's true. And, you know, in this case, it was a particularly poignant situation, actually, because J. Arthur Brown and his cohorts, and possibly the curators, lawyers, and everyone else associated, stole money literally from the mouths of orphans and widows. I mean, these are people who were dependent on the Mine Workers Providence Fund, which paid out to the families of injured mine workers. That is where the money was coming from. This isn't some, like, faceless, victimless crime where, you know, a big company got a bit skimmed off the top. This is money for school fees, for funerals, for retirements. It's really terribly, terribly sad.
And amounts that ran into the billions. You know, so to think that the initial fine was 150,000 rand of the suspended sentence, you know, maybe that judge should be put on trial for handing something down like that down.
And it seems hugely unlikely that any of those people are really going to recover their money. There was talk of a few million being paid out, but I've heard from people saying they still haven't seen any of that money. They don't know what's happening, and, you know, I doubt that money's coming back to them.
Cool.
Just quickly, Rebecca, the change in judgment from the High Court to the SCA seems so huge. Did the Supreme Court of Appeal have any harsh words for the High Court judge? Because it seems it's such a huge difference. Surely the Supreme Court of Appeal must have rebuked the High Court and sort of set a tone for how things should go forth?
Yeah, they did. They absolutely did. Because the minimum prescribed sentence for a start in cases of fraud exceeding 500,000 rand is 15 years in jail. And Judge Anton Saltazen in this case thought there was a sufficient leeway to not impose that sentence. But he also took into account stuff like the fact that J. Arthur Brown had been scorned by his community and scorned by his church, which he seemed to think was a punishment in itself, which I think a lot of us would say is crazy when you're stolen. Well, being, you know, at the wheel when a billion rand goes missing. They did. They said that Saltazen had been, you know, was deserving of censure, but he's got it wrong, essentially. And I'm not sure what the answer is, but what happens in cases like this? What happens when a judge is declared by the Supreme Court to be deserving of censure? Are there steps that get taken? Are they subject to disciplinary review? I'm not sure what happens there. I don't know if you do.
No idea.
Yeah. I wonder if they're given a bye over next week's game.
That's right.
They get to sit on the sidelines. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show, and we look forward to chatting to you again soon.
Thanks, guys. Keep well. Yeah.
Cheers.
Greg, you have got, what's coming up for you? I believe you've got you've been assigned to the EFF conference coming up in a couple weeks' time.
Yeah.
You looking forward to that? What are you expecting?
I'm expecting chairs coming at my head and bricks and pangas. Who knows, actually? To be honest, I have no idea what to expect. Like, honestly, some of the regional conferences, such as in Northern Cape, I think it was Northern Cape, where we've seen actually blood, literally blood on the floor, with delegates fighting. And they're fighting for positions, and I think it's largely because a lot of the people who have joined EFF are former ANC Youth League structures who were disbanded by the ANC National Task Team to the Youth League and lost their livelihoods or their future access to positions and potentially further wealth that comes with those positions. And so
what are you implying?
Yeah, I mean, the ambition of a corporate, of a political career, I mean, you know, to serve the people really is what they've
missed out on. Of course. No, yes. I wouldn't imply anything. Yes. But so there is extreme tension over who gets access to a relatively smaller amount of positions if you compare it with what you might have got if you were rising in the ANC. So we actually have seen blood on the floor at multiple ANC conferences so far. So I wouldn't be surprised if we do see some actual fighting, some real shit go down. So I'm going to be prepared for that. Just
so I mean, we were talking about this, you know, just looking back to when we all went and covered the ANC National Conference in 2012 in Mangung, and obviously the EFF conference is going to be in Mangung now. This is going to be the first national conference. So yeah, it's just weird to kind of go have, you know, no idea what you expect. You know, it's their first one. You know, what's the organization going to be like? You know, at least with the ANC National Conference, you've got, you know, they had quite a few conferences you know, before. Organization was, you know, I guess could always be better, but at least, you know, they've got the budgets and the experience of previous ones. So not quite sure what to expect with the EFF this time around.
I think that's the interesting thing as well going forward, because the EFF really have made an impact on politics. Everyone knows it and can feel it. But the future of the EFF and whether it's going to be a viable and sustainable party that can build and potentially either challenge the ANC or get enough votes to then potentially enter into some sort of coalitions to govern certain areas will largely depend on their organizational stability. So if the EFF is able to have a smooth conference, elect leaders democratically without too many grievances of bias or vote rigging or...
Show that it can roll up and grow branches.
That's
and,
right.
And implement those structures, I think.
That's what will determine the EFF's future, and we really don't know about that so far, because we've seen when Julius Malema led the ANC Youth League, he led it with an iron fist, and the National Task Team, who have been looking into the Youth League structures, basically say that it was a fiefdom, you know, there was gatekeeping, anyone who spoke out against the leaders were crushed without mercy. And I think if there are those same tactics in the EFF, we'll see it split and dwindle again. It's never going to grow, and I think we'll see it turn into a cope. If they can actually maintain some sort of internal democracy and stability and unity within competitions and contested elections, then we might see it grow. But that's what we're waiting to see. But it's going to be quite interesting, because you have this set of leaders in the EFF, Julius Malema and those around him, who are so powerful and so strong and so publicly known. Will anyone challenge them? And if people do challenge their leadership, how will they be treated?
It's almost as if they'll need, I mean, obviously given his history and how the Youth League was run, as you mentioned, it's almost like they need someone to come in with that on-the-ground stuff, you know, that the actual, you know, bricks-and-mortar efforts that are required to grow a political party beyond just, you know, shouting in Parliament and grabbing headlines.
And that's going to be the thing, because obviously this stuff happens, you know, behind the scenes. So I think it's going to be a chance for us to actually be able to judge and evaluate how they've gone so far. We'll see how many branches they've set up, how many members they have, and whether they can actually even run a conference, because running a conference is actually a huge task. So it'll be really, really interesting to see whether they do have, if the EFF does have people in, you know, in the background who are working very hard to set up these structures, because it's growing very fast and they must have strong organizational capacity, and whether they can survive for the future. But I'm not sure if we can just touch quickly on another story that I'm not sure if it's come out today that isn't the most positive sign for the EFF. Do you know a guy called Papiki Babule?
No.
Who he was an ANC Youth League member, and in the run-up to the ANC's 2012 Mangung conference. He was charged for assassinating another youth, another ANC leader. He's now been convicted of murder, and then a few days later was elected the leader of the EFF in the Northwest. Allowed to stand, a convicted murderer. And the EFF is out here defending themselves, saying, no, he's going to appeal, so we must let the court procedures run its course. But It could be years, and I just don't think it's a good image and a good tone to set for the EFF if it's trying to move away from the ANC. We have Julius Malema's charges still outstanding against him. We have now the leader in the Northwest, where they do have a strong base, is charged with murder. What does it say about the EFF in comparison to the claims that they have against the ANC, that Zuma won't pay back the money? This guy's convicted of murder.
Greg, is there any possibility that we could see any sort of maybe big-name defections, to the EFF being announced at this conference? I mean, have they caused enough of a ruckus that, there might be, people who are unhappy with, internal politics at Luthuli House, that they might, see this as an opportunity to move across onto something that's growing momentum, regardless of, the lack of perceived structure?
It's always a possibility. Of course, we saw that with COPE quite a bit, and certain ANC members have moved to DA in the past few years. But I think what generally happens with defections is people move when they're sidelined, when their faction doesn't win and they have no longer have an access to positions. When they still have access to positions and their slate wins, they just toe the line, regardless if they're happy with Zuma's corruption or other sort of alleged corruption or other policies. I think as well, one of the things with EFF now is people are quite cautious of moving to the EFF, at least some of the old hands of the ANC, because of... there's so much we don't know about them, and they are populists. They've got this sort of strong stance where you have to stand up in parliament and cause a ruckus. I think people are quite cautious of moving to such a party. And also we already saw quite a large number of defections from the Youth League and certain structures of the ANC to the EFF. At the same time, people are also, I think some ANC members, some will, of course, go over to the EFF. I don't know if we'll see any large ones, but some other ones are looking to see whether the NUMSA will start a workers' party. That could see a whole lot of defections, and that's what we're waiting for, really.
Okay. We're about to wrap things up. Simon, anything you're working on this week that's of note, or are you just throwing a dart at a map of Africa?
Someone told me yesterday Simon had dengue fever.
Yes, I did.
Okay, anyway, moving on.
Yeah, you missed that part of the show where we wanted to put him into quarantine, Greg. Yes. Are you throwing a dart at the map of Africa and picking a problem that comes
I am
up,
today, but for the rest of the week, I'm looking into what the hell is going on in Zambia. Now, of course, the president died, and they've got this new white president in the interim. And there's all kinds of shenanigans going on in the ruling party and trying to figure
jockeying
out
for position,
where the power lies there. So I'll probably look into that.
Cool. Well, that's about all we've got time for this week. Thank you for listening. If you downloaded the podcast, thanks for downloading. You can catch Daily Maverick at dailymaverick.co.za. The First Thing newsletter, also from Daily Maverick, or the Daily Dose from cliffcentral.com. We look forward to hosting you next week again at the same time live, 1 o'clock on a Tuesday, available at cliffcentral.com or the podcast from Daily Maverick, Cliff Central, or iTunes.